comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors. And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It is the show where you matter. And we are here for a very specific reason. It is because you have a right to know. You know, the Japanese earthquake of March the 11th and then the ensuing devastation, the tsunami and the devastation to life, property, and to some nuclear reactors is very much upon the minds of people all around the world, and with good reason. Anytime there's any kind of natural disaster where there is such tremendous loss of life, it affects sort of the global psyche. I don't think there's anyone on the planet who doesn't feel that when it happens. Also, a follow-on disaster would be the massive property damage and the tremendous dent in the world economy that makes. That causes people to continue to think about this and talk about it, because it is a follow-on result of the tragedy. But on top of that, we have damaged nuclear reactors, four of them, that pose a credible danger to the planet. And so it's something that a lot of people have on their minds. A lot of people are talking about it. And of course, the news media, major media, they've done what everybody does, what they always do at times like this. It was all big news, and everybody was broadcasting what was going on and getting all of the information out there. And that's a good thing. But, hey, you know, we have to look out for ratings, right? And so, even though this is a continuing and developing story, it's off of the front page. And, you know, they report a little bit here, a little bit there, but it's no longer the big news that it was when it first happened. And that's unfortunate. Very unfortunate. Because what we have is a situation with these nuclear reactors that really could be a big, big problem for the whole planet. But we're not getting much out of that. And in terms of news reporting, we're not getting much information out of there. We are going to take a look at this phenomenal tragedy a couple of times this week from a couple of different perspectives, beginning tonight. One of the things that people have been asking about is, was it a natural disaster? So we'll talk about that with Ted Tweetmeyer right after this. And And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Ted Tweetmeyer, joining us to talk about this really tragic phenomena that took place on March the 11th, the earthquake and then the tsunami that hit Japan and the ensuing damage. Ted, welcome back to the show.
Kevin.
Ted, I don't think there's anything else in the news that's quite as big as this earthquake. I know now, you know, they've turned their attention to Libya and the cruise missiles, but you know, there doesn't seem to be anything happening on the planet that's quite as big and quite as important as this earthquake and its aftermath. And one of the reasons, of course, has to do with those damaged nuclear reactors and the potential danger that they pose for the whole world. But one of the questions that was on everybody's mind right from the start was this a natural disaster, or was this a disaster that was either created by man or at least enhanced and sort of kicked over the edge by man? Now, folks, we talked about this early on, and I had talked about with Walter Bosley, had talked about various scenarios. You may remember that. And we came to the conclusion that we thought that all of the evidence available at that time suggested that it was a natural disaster. It seemed to be pointing in that direction. Well, I don't know which way it's going to point tonight, but I will tell you this. After that show, I received an email from one of you, one of our listeners, and the email had a link in it. And the link was to the HARP site, and a particular page at the HARP site where you can take a look at charts. And there were instructions in the email telling me to look at a week ago, to check the box that says, you know, show the data for a week ago. Now, it's more than a week ago now, but here's the chart that was on that page, and we will talk about it some more a little bit later. But I sent it to Ted Tweetmeyer and asked him to take a look at it and asked him if he would do a little bit of research into this and see what he could find out about what was going on with the earthquake and what does that particular chart indicate. So he has done that and has prepared a chart of his own for us tonight. But Ted, just sort of introduce us to what you took a look at and what you were looking for.
Well, it was curious. The our discussion between you and me was somewhat timely, and there's a bit of an echo in the line.
Nothing I can do about it, Ted. You'll just have to press forward.
Okay. Well, in looking at this, there seems to be a connection between X-ray flares, to be specific, and the earthquakes. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that's noticed it, but the curious thing about this is that we have been entering a period, of course, of higher and higher X-ray flare activity with the sun, and specifically coronal mass ejections, which are the ones I'm focused mainly on, because I have a theory about what a CME actually is, but to talk about your chart you sent, it's showing magnetic deviation in nanoteslas, which is an extremely small unit measurement. In fact, it's another magnitude smaller than micro. So It's pretty darn small. And I'm not quite sure why they're showing that, because the HAARP facility is mainly an RF facility. So the sun is, its magnetic field is also measured in nanoteslas.
Okay, so the chart that was on the HAARP site and that I sent to you is showing fluctuations in Earth's magnetic field, right?
Well, I believe that's the idea there. You know, I didn't get any accompanying text, so you know, I think that's what the idea is.
Okay, now the what we're looking at shows on the 10th, 11th, and coming up to the 12th of March, we're showing on this chart wild fluctuations in the magnetic field of the Earth, and then it begins to level out and becomes virtually level, well, by the 14th.
Well, logical question, Kevin, to ask would be, is this the cause or is it an effect?
Okay.
You know, so we don't quite yet know that, you know, but this could be a side effect of the flare activity or something else.
Okay. Now, you were already taking a look at solar flares. You were already examining whether solar flares had something to do with earthquakes, right?
Yes.
Why?
Well, having seen that there is a connection of when there is multiple flares, which we experienced this month, between the basically the 10th, and then they began to taper off around the 14th to 17th area, I started to look at this with a possibility that with certain types of flares, that perhaps a gravity wave of some type is projected by the sun. You know, the coronal mass ejection itself is only reaches Earth basically as radiation, because it's long cooled from being in a plasma, superheated plasma state at the sun, before it even gets anywhere near Earth. So it doesn't seem likely that that's going to cause an earthquake. So I started looking at this to say, okay, what could cause an earthquake? You know, we know earthquakes are some type of movement with the tectonic plates in the Earth. So what kind of force would there be that's strong enough, powerful enough, to displace a plate in the Earth? And that's what got me looking at this. And the more I looked into it, the more interesting it got. Because, you know, we began having a series of M-class, which are material doesn't really leave the sun. It goes out into space and it goes back in. And then the X-class, which tend to eject mass from the sun. And sometimes Earth is in the way of one of these, and sometimes it's not. In 1989, it was in the way, and that knocked out the power in Quebec for about 5 days. So, and the reason that happened is it ionized the atmosphere.
Okay, now you prepared a chart for us, and I'll put it up, and I'd like for us to discuss it. But before I do that, let me ask you if you... Did we have any X-class solar flares in the time period around this earthquake?
Oh, most definitely. There was an X and M, an X and an M, alternating like that.
Hmm.
Which
All right.
is interesting.
Well, I've got the chart up on our TV channel, and if you would explain to us your chart.
Okay. We have, I know it looks like a lot of information on there. The reason it's put together this way is because, you know, we're dealing with two totally different types of measurements. The Richter scale is one, and then the earthquakes, you know, for earthquakes, and then the flares have a different kind of weighting used by astronomers. So this is an attempt to show, all the way back to the first of the year, what's been happening. Now, the reason I went back that far is I wanted to try to remove the supermoon effects, if any. You know, there's been a lot of talk that this has been blamed on the supermoon, and I really don't see any evidence of that yet to be the case. Okay, but so at the left side of the scale is a Richter scale, 0 to 10. And each of the vertical bars has the area of the world that was affected, according to the USGS website, where I collected this data from, and also from NASA for the flare activity. Now, I could not find some good flare information that went back beyond the middle of February, which is why you don't see those over to the left. But I did list the earthquakes, and they've been pretty much averaging 6.4 since the first of the year. And that would include, of course, the Japan earthquake as well. So we see a lot of these hit in the Pacific area. And so what you see is, for each earthquake, there's a yellow bar and a green bar. The green bar just simply either goes up to the M-class line or the X-class. And then the yellow bar is the, we're talking about the flares, the yellow bar is the actual magnitude of the flare. So the curious thing is that, you know, we had this bit of fairly average earthquake offshore of Male, Chile, back in February 13th, and a fairly substantial flare, which was an M-class flare, where no mass really left the sun. It, you know, it went out, it looped out in the magnetic field, and it came back into the sun. But what made the time period around the middle of March with the Japan earthquakes interesting is there was an X class and an M and an X and an M alternating. I'm sorry, you were speaking?
I said nothing. We're waiting, just listening.
Okay. So we were alternating back and forth, and then we hit that 9 or 8.9 on the 12th of March.
Okay, but now it looks like in that period where we have yellow and green bars, we start off left to right. We have yellow and green, and then an earthquake. Then we have yellow and green, no earthquake, green, and an earthquake.
Yeah, the tall green bar is an X class. The short one is the M.
Okay. If we keep moving to the right, we get to several earthquakes there that are pretty substantial that don't seem to have any solar activity associated with them.
To the right? What do you mean? I'm sorry.
If you start from left to right on your chart, you come from left to right. We get to the first yellow bar, then the first green bar, and then an earthquake. Then we have a yellow bar and a green bar. Then we have a green bar and an earthquake.
Yeah.
Okay, then we have a green bar and a strong earthquake. And then we have, after that earthquake, one, two, three earthquakes where there's no solar flare.
Yeah, I'm not saying that there's going to be a guarantee there's going to be a, you know, that a quake will follow a flare. Yeah, I'm not implying that at all.
Okay. But I guess, what are you saying then? That it, not that it will happen, but that it is possible that there is a correlation between strong flares and earthquakes. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. So it's a question of, you know, what are the odds and probabilities? You go X class, M, X, and M. And when that's happening, that Japan would get hit twice. So, you know, the first one was a 7.2, and the second one was a 9.
Mm-hmm. You know, looking at the chart, one of the things that's pretty interesting, and I had not understood this until I see this indicated in the chart. I thought that the, whether it was an M class or an X class, had to do with how strong that solar flare was. But it apparently does not. It has to do with whether it reaches to Earth or not.
That's right. M class don't. The X class are the strongest, and they go out into space and they don't go back to the sun. So,
but you have an M class, the very first one moving from left to right. Looks like it was on my monitor. It's my monitor's got it too small. Let me enhance this a little bit. This looks like it was February the 13th. You have an M class. So, you know, it's not one that's going to reach Earth, but the yellow bar indicates that it was huge, however, did not reach Earth. Now, we have X class on the 15th, on 17th, and then again on March the 10th.
Well, 21st, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting, see, is there wasn't the smaller flares in between.
Mm-hmm.
As there was when the really big quakes hit. That's why it seems like something's going on there. You know, this is fairly new research, so, you know, there's probably quite a lot more to do, I'm sure of it.
Okay, so then what the charts would seem to be indicating is that the solar flares do not necessarily cause the earthquake, but enhance the strength of an earthquake. Is that right?
I'd like to qualify this by saying that not all X-class flares are pointed at Earth.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You know, and I can't say I have the data, and I've been having a heck of a time just getting this data. You know, in fact, I had to get a lot of it from an Australian website.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we will be back with Ted Tweetmeyer right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Ted Tweetmeyer. And just a little background on Ted Tweetmeyer for those of you who maybe have not run across him before, although he's been all over UFO talk shows for a number of years. Ted is an engineer, and he has worked in the aerospace industry. He has been project manager for a number of projects at NASA, including installation of launch controls at Cape Canaveral. And Ted, looking at the chart that you provided, we see X-class, we see M-class flares, and we see earthquake activity. Now, on the 10th, I'm sorry, yes, on the 10th, of March, there was an earthquake in Japan. On the 11th, there was the big one. But the one on the 10th was sizable itself. And then we see just sort of a cluster of earthquakes and solar flares happening, XM. And it looks like there's a correlation, but I'd like to get you to tell us what you think the correlation may be.
Well, it's two different types of flares are being generated, and there was an interesting comment made by NASA about what happened on the 9th, and they stated that there was little impact is predicted to happen for the flare on the 9th. Of course, we all know what happened 2 days later was not very good.
Okay, so let's take a look at the chart again for the solar flare on the 9th. So there's little impact. What do you think they meant by that?
Well, I don't know what they meant, you know. In fact, they also had said that they did not expect another X-class flare in the next 24 hours. No, there wasn't. There was an M-class, and the next day there was another X-class after that. So that was interesting. Also, the interesting thing about the X-class around the... I'm looking between two screens here. Yeah, around the 18th, they said that there was a really bright flash associated with that, which was seen. And I've seen the movie of it, so to speak, and it is. It's like a flashbulb going off, which was considered very unusual. There's been some very unusual activity with the sun, especially considering that just about 2 years ago, one of the two X-ray wavelengths that the GOES satellites, GOES, the Geo Orbiting Earth Stationary satellite, captured was when that occurred, they didn't know what to make of what was happening. And what happened was the one of the two X-ray wavelengths essentially went flatline from the satellite. Now, that was a curious thing, and NASA said, well, we must have a satellite malfunction. Well, they didn't. And the way they actually measure X-rays is having one sensor with multiple filters in front of it. And they don't use filters like you might think, like you do in photography. The filters are made out of materials like polyethylene, aluminum, and other materials that are designed to only let certain X-ray wavelengths through. No visible light at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... And it turned out there was really nothing wrong with the satellite because over time that flatline chart began to have little blips on it and finally it became fully active. So the sun suddenly stopped putting out this one particular X-ray wavelength. And, of course, nobody understands why that occurred. So this particular solar cycle has had some very, very strange things happening with it that go back a few years now.
Yeah, I remember when you were on with us before, you provided the charts and we showed them on our TV channel about the X-ray, this particular wavelength of X-ray going flat. Does anybody have any idea as to, if not what causes it, what effect it has? Does anybody have any idea about what effect that might have on the Earth?
Yeah, I've heard nothing about it, you know, because those wavelengths don't normally reach us, thankfully. We'd be in a world of trouble if they did. But there's so little that's understood about the actual mechanism of the sun. You know, there's a lot of theories. In fact, while we're on that subject, let me state some interesting facts about the sun that some folks might not know about.
All right.
The surface we see, which is known as a photosphere, averages about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's believed the temperature at the core, or the center of it, is 27 million degrees. The diameter of the sun is about 870,000 miles. So it's the distance to the moon averages about 300,000 miles. So that gives you an idea just how big it is. It's 333,000 times heavier than the Earth. It's 695,000 kilometers at its equator. It rotates once every 27 days. That's pretty amazing in itself when you think about it. It's believed to be made of 92% hydrogen, 70% helium, and then a low number of other gases. So it's pretty massive, and we don't fully understand, you know, everything going on inside it or even how it actually works. You know, scientists' attempts to make fusion reactors have met with pretty dismal failure because they're basing it on, you know, compression, whereas the sun works basically because of its massive size. You know, it's self-contained. You know, a fusion reactor, they're attempting to compress it, a pellet from every direction.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the sun is just huge.
So we don't really, when it comes to the sun, we don't really know much about it.
We really don't. You know, in fact, it's kind of scary in a way. I mean, we know more about just about everything else but that, because probing it is a pretty darn difficult thing to do. You know, this solar cycle has another interesting caveat. This is called solar cycle 24 because it's the 24th cycle since we've been began monitoring them, you know, a couple centuries ago. According to NASA, the intensity of the geomagnetic storms during the solar cycle 24 may be elevated because there was a breach. A large breach was found in Earth's magnetic field, and this was discovered by the Themis spacecraft back in 2008. So they're seeing a 20-fold increase in particle counts that penetrate the Earth's magnetic field can be expected. So that could be a hint of what's coming.
All right, well, I want us to come back to that. But early on, you said that you were looking at the possibility that there was, in fact, some kind of that the sun was producing some kind of a wave that was hitting the Earth that was enhancing these earthquakes.
I think it's focused. I think it's a focused, what's known as a collimated beam.
Oh, okay. And why do you think so?
Well, let me explain the term collimated to folks to help them. A laser diode, which, you know, are everywhere. A laser diode, actually the bare diode itself, doesn't put a beam of light out. It just glows. It looks like an LED. You actually have to put a lens in front of it to collimate the light into a beam. Well, okay, you can almost think of the sun kind of like a spray paint can. You know, when a flare ejects out of it, there should be nothing really to keep it going, you know, but spreading out into space. And by the time it travels the 93 million miles, we're talking about an X-class mass ejection, by the time it travels the 93 million miles to Earth, you know, it should be wide enough to encompass the whole Earth. I mean, does that seem logical?
Yeah, it would seem logical, yes.
Okay, but back in 89, we saw this didn't happen. We saw it was Quebec, who, in that specific area, which is a rather small part of our globe, really, had the air ionized by the flare so badly that the high-voltage insulators arced over and they could not turn the power on for almost a full week. So that shows right there that this can be a pretty focused event. You know, that it happened to strike that particular part of the Earth. It could have hit anywhere, and that particular time it happened to hit there. It could have hit over New York. It could hit over L.A. or, you know, any city.
Okay, so what would be functioning as the lens? What's causing it to get focused into a beam, a column?
Well, that's the tough part. I'm not an astrophysicist, and I'm sure a lot of them would take exception to what I'm saying, and I wouldn't be surprised. But clearly there's evidence that something focuses the mass ejection, not into like a laser-type beam, but into some type of a elongated, focused, highly charged particle column, if you will. You know, and wherever it goes out into space, it just keeps going until it hits something. And I would imagine at some point, you know, there's a distance where it would just dissipate harmlessly, but we know we're clearly within target range. I mean, history's certainly proven that.
Mm-hmm.
So what it is, you know, the mechanism, I would love to know, you know, and, you know, and I'd love to actually understand it better.
What's the possibility that what we really might be looking at is a piggyback event?
Oh, I want to point something else out too, mm-hmm. Kevin. One other thing is this. Normally it takes about 24 hours for the mass ejection to reach Earth. But we saw that the effects were not instantaneous, but not far from it. You know, when these flares occurred and the earthquake hit at the same time. See, remember on that chart, okay, those the yellow, green, and blue bars are one day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if there was a focused gravity wave or, you know, some other type of...
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Ted Tweetmeyer, and we're talking about this phenomenal tragedy that took place over in Japan, the earthquake, of course, and then the aftermath of it. But we're talking about it in relationship to the sun and just trying to examine if there is a correlation between the solar flares and earthquakes. Now, there is a person, I don't know, Ted, if you're familiar with him. His name is Mitch Batros. And,
oh, yeah.
Mitch seems to think that there is a correlation.
Yes, there is, but I don't know if he's actually gone as far as I have on this. I don't know for sure, but, you know, so there is something going on. You know, it's just not well understood. And the problem is you need an interdisciplinary type approach to this where astronomers and geologists work together. And it's been my experience getting two different types of scientists to work together is no easy thing to do.
Yeah, and I can understand. You know, for one thing, there each is a fish out of water in the other's world. And
not just that, but the problem is today everything is grant driven.
Yeah.
If there isn't grant money for it, they won't even waste any time talking about it.
Okay, now I brought up something earlier. I want us to deal with it, and that is, what is the possibility that we're looking at piggyback events? In other words, you have a solar flare and then a man-made event piggybacked on the solar flare to sort of cover that. Is that possible?
Well, it's possible, and the implications of it could be way beyond anything anybody would understand. But, you know, the problem is when you do a computer simulation, you know, it's the global warming people showed us. You can make it say anything you want and do it real good and make it real convincing, because, you know, the modeling is only as good as the data you put into it and the software you're running.
All right, now you took the chart that I sent you and you lined it up with data on the chart that you constructed. And when we put them together, the chart that I sent you is copied. It's a screenshot right off of the HARP website. Their verbiage that goes with it says that this is the magnetometer readings. There are three lines here, and they sort of run all over each other, but. These are magnetometer readings as they were monitoring the Earth's magnetosphere, or magnetic field. And if folks take a look at this chart, it fits into the last little part of your chart. And what we see is that from the 10th, 11th, and 12th, the Earth's magnetic field was fluctuating wildly. Now, at that time, we were having X-class and then M-class solar flares and the big earthquake. What is this a... Is the Earth's magnetic field fluctuating wildly here because of things going on in the Earth that are producing this earthquake, or is it fluctuating wildly because of the solar flares, and does the fluctuation of the magnetic field enhance the earthquake? Which way does this go?
Well, this is pretty complex stuff, but if we look at that chart you're referring to, it went, you know, the center of the chart means no deviation at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the blue line is plunged and apparently bottomed out at minus 500, and the black line has gone up to, what would that be, maybe 300, 350, something like that. It's not calibrated at that point. So it isn't bipolar, you know. Bipolar would say, okay, it goes an even amount both ways. In other words, just like the AC in your wall goes above and below 0 volts, you know,
mm-hmm.
even amount. And, well, this apparently, an equal amount, excuse me, this apparently is not, and although it may look like noise, there is something in there. In fact, we can see, if you look to the right of the chart, there's something very curious there. On the 15th, 16th, and 17th, it dipped slightly negative by, what's this thing calibrated in, about 50 nanoteslas. It didn't even go quite that much, but you can see three evenly spaced dips right there.
Yeah. Right on the 15th, right on the 16th, and right on the 17th. And by the way, these readings are taken for the whole chart. They're taken at the time is 2011 UTC. That's 8 p.m. UTC time, or universal time.
Which most people might remember as Greenwich Mean Time. Mm-hmm. same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So all these readings are taken at the same time each day, and each day on the 15th, the 16th, and the 17th, they dip.
Yes. And, well, we see variations in that same black line where the earthquake activity happened. We don't see the same kind of spacing there.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. So,
well, yeah, but my question still is, and I know there may be no answer to this at this point, but my question still is, we look at this chart, we see the Earth's magnetic field going wild on the 10th, 11th, and 12th. Is that because there is earthquake activity going on? And it's affecting the magnetic field, or is the magnetic field fluctuating for some reason and causing the earthquake?
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. Is it a cause or is it an effect?
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, I think we're seeing an effect here of something else that's the cause. Because we're talking about billions of a Tesla, you know, so we're talking about an extremely small unit of measure, but there's a signature there, you know, I mean, there is a signature there. So, you know, it's kind of challenging, you know, so...
Okay, so what do you think? You think it's an effect, but an effect of what? Something natural or something man-made?
It's, you know, if we had some RF levels up taken up there or something, or if we knew of the activity of that system that day, that might help answer that, but we really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the whole facility kind of went black not long after it was opened.
Yeah, and it's not classified. The HAARP project is not classified. Just try to get in and take a look around.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's, you know, this is that old game where, you know, it's out there in plain sight, but you don't know what it's being used for.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's like a nuclear sub, you know?
Yeah. All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this, folks. Don't go away. Thank you for being here this evening, and welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I am delighted you are here, and you have truly missed a universe of information if you missed that first hour. We're talking with Ted Tweetmeyer, and we're talking about the earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan. And we're talking about whether or not there is some big force acting on Earth that caused that. And so we're sort of picking through the data right now. And Ted, before we went away for break, I had asked, and I understand that, you know, there is no definitive answer at this point, but this fluctuation of the Earth's magnetic field that is witnessed in this chart from HARP. I had asked, is that fluctuation a result of the earthquake activity, or is it something, is it registering something that is causing this fluctuation, and the fluctuation acting on Earth causes the earthquake? And I understand there's no definitive answer for that. And we don't have available to us, at least I could not find, and I looked for it, we don't have available to us a chart that shows HARP transmission activity during this period of time. Were you able to find one?
Yeah, I didn't have time to look for it since we, in the last couple of days I've been working on this. I haven't had time to go research that. The one thing that seems to be hard to find is older solar flare activity. As I mentioned earlier in the show, I found it on a website run by the Australian government, that they have a couple observatories down there. So I was able to get at least the last month or so, 30 days I think it was. But I had trouble finding older flare activity. I found that very interesting, and I spent hours digging and looking for it too.
Why do you think that data seems to be so curiously missing?
I don't know, but it was the last thing I expected. You know, I thought, well, this won't take very long. Yeah, right. I spent the better part of the weekend on this, digging into this, only to keep hitting dead ends. I was very surprised at that.
Well, when I say missing, it probably, the data is not missing.
Well,
not available.
That's it. It's ferreted away somewhere. I used all kinds of different keywords and searches, and I just could not believe it wouldn't come up. I could get the earthquake information relatively easily in detail, but the flare activity did not go back very far. Now, I know that some of the sun's activity is relatively recent, but I know there has been flare activity since the beginning of the year, and that's what I was hoping to get my hands on.
You said this solar cycle 24 is very unusual. Do you think it's going to get more intense and thus worse for us, or is it going to start to quieten down?
I think we're going to see this increase through this year and into next year. Astronomers have seen distant stars emit such a burst of mass ejection that it was visible from Earth. We're talking a lot of light years away. And the distance it went out was like from the sun to Saturn. I mean, it was way more than 93 million miles. So they know that stars can fry planets around them. It's a pretty sobering discovery when they found that.
Yeah, it's sort of, once you discover that, makes you realize you're not the captain of your own ship.
I'd say not.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, let me ask you this. And I don't know that you and I have ever talked about Planet X or Nibiru. I don't know that we've ever talked about that. But, I don't know what you think about Planet X and Nibiru. Let me pose the hypothetical. Let's hypothetically say that it's a reality and that it is incoming. Wouldn't it be pushing forces in front of it, like the bow of a ship moving the water? Wouldn't it be pushing forces in front of it that could impact on our solar system, perhaps on our sun, enough to make it do weird stuff and make our magnetic field do weird stuff? Couldn't that be the case?
Well, it could be attracting things in front of it. You know, a star warps space, which is where, of course, the orbits of the planets come from. And this warp is pretty substantial. I mean, you know, look how far out Pluto is, you know, and it stays in orbit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's a long way out there. The planet that's no longer a planet anymore. It's just a rock.
Yeah.
So we're told, right?
Yeah.
But here's something interesting. You know, I liken this whole thing to standing at the end of a very long, straight, flat road. You see that there's a vehicle coming, but you can't tell what it is. It's, say, a mile away. It gets a little closer, well, it's a truck, you know, and then a little closer, maybe you can make out the color, and a little closer, you can tell what make it is. And just as it's going by, you can see everything you needed to know. And here's something interesting that really got me thinking. I was recently approached, because of the book I wrote about Mars, by a TV network to do an interview. But what this was about colonies on Mars. Now, I told the producer, I said, this is going to give you a lot of trouble. I said, you are going to run into some serious walls about this. And they did. In fact, I was told that it looks like the show will never get made. Now, this was for a major series that delves into all kinds of unexplained things, and if I had told you the name, you'd say, oh yeah, I've seen that show. I mean, it's very well known.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't disclose it. And we had a number of discussions about things, and it came down to them that this was not to be talked about. So there are colonies on Mars. They are there. And why are they there? Because, you know, governments probably knew many decades ago when these colonies were put there, you know, when they decided to have them, they knew that something could happen that could be an extinction-level event.
So the producers of this TV show, which is a well-known TV show,
oh, yeah,
have communicated to you that this show they were going to do about Mars colonies, they got word from on high, forget it, this is not something you talk about.
That's basically the way it came to me. That it looks like at this point it's never going to be made. You know, I was a little bit surprised on one hand, but not on another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talks were going well. I mean, I wasn't going to get paid to do it. I was, you know, I think mainly it was the work I did that showed that, you know, Mars has a blue sky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the various landers, the several of them that have landed there have seen the blue sky, and NASA has tinted the images red to make them look red. It's the most ridiculous thing on Earth. But they don't want you to know that it very well might have a breathable atmosphere. You know, what was the last vehicle that was going to land on Mars was built by the European Space Agency, and it was a sort of a sub-vehicle. You know, there was I apologize, I forgot the name of the European space mission, but when it got into orbit around Mars, it launched a small lander called the Beagle.
Yeah.
Okay, and, you know, that thing was designed and built by the finest minds in Europe, and I guess they even had a little help from NASA since, you know. And the Beagle went silent. They never, ever heard from it again.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was air on the planet, it would have told everybody.
Well, we're getting a little bit off track here, but that I'm glad that you brought it up, and let me tell you why. A NASA scientist himself, and a very famous one, Dr. Harold Klein, already told the world. When the Viking lander landed, he said, and I have the recording of it, he said, what we found there was something, and this is a quote, something like 15 times more oxygen in that atmosphere than we can account for from all known sources. He said that publicly. It was aired, it was recorded, and I have a recording of it. So, you know, I'm sure they weren't real happy about him making that disclosure, but he did. And, you know, it's out there for all time now because he did say it. But let's go back to Planet X for a minute.
I'd like to just add to that that the European Space Agency orbiting spacecraft detected high levels of methane in the upper atmosphere of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And methane only comes from a couple different sources, which is plants and volcanoes and, you know, the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But it's generally decaying plant matter that creates methane.
Yeah, and there are no active volcanoes on Mars.
Right. So, where is it coming from? Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry to distract you, but...
Yeah, well, that's no problem. But back to Planet X. Now, as I said, I've never asked you what your views are on that. And so let me do that now. What are your views? What are the possibilities that these stories about an incoming huge planet might be true stories?
Well, the Sumerians wrote about it, and I think Sitchin was probably the first guy to translate those ancient tablets and talk about it. You know, and then in recent years, there's been other issues like Google Sky has had part of it blacked out, which happens to be right where Planet X is supposed to be. You know, it says no data available.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a whole series of dots you can connect that do seem to point to the idea that something is out there, whether it's a brown dwarf, you know, on a very long elliptical orbit, we don't know, but they have, astronomers have acknowledged in recent years that stars can be rogue. They're not all just parked in one spot or just quietly orbiting a galaxy like ours is, that some of them could just be traveling throughout the universe. And it makes sense. Yeah, it makes complete sense when you think about it.
We also have the IRIS satellite, and the chief scientist for the IRIS, which was infrared, the IRIS satellite in 1983 said, we found something out there, and we don't know what it is, but it's huge.
Yes. There's something out there. I mean, and if it went whizzing by Earth, it could create all kinds of pandemonium. I mean, look at what the moon can do to the tides. And it's only 2,000 miles across. You know, it's a fraction of the size of a star.
Okay, well, let's say that this is not a star. Let's say that it's a big planet. Well, it could be a star. But it's a big object. Something on the order of Jupiter.
Oh.
Okay? Maybe a little smaller. Okay? And it comes through here, as Sitchin tells us, every 3,600 years. Let's just say that that's the case. And it's on a very long elliptical orbit, and it's a highly inclined orbit, as Sitchin tells us. So... we'll just assume all that's true. What sort of forces could we expect to see exerted on the Earth as it enters the inner solar system? What effects could we expect to see happen on the Earth?
Well, you know, it would create massive storm, you know, massive surges in the ocean. You know, and if it was trailing rocks behind it, you know, they could be caught by the Earth's gravity and come plummeting in the, what is it, the Hopis call it, the sack of ashes, and, You know,
now, these massive surges on the ocean, you mean something like these rogue waves that seem to have begun to strike more frequently?
Well, think about the moon, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is averaging about 300,000 miles away, and it's just 2,000 miles across. If you're on the moon, it's 1/6 of the Earth's gravity when you're standing on the moon. You know, the astronauts were wearing, you know, 300-pound backpacks, and they didn't weigh much of anything to them when they were on the moon. So, so you have and the moon, which creates tremendous, has a tremendous effect on the oceans. You know, without it, there'd be no tides. You know, and the moon can create tides upwards of 20 feet, like up in the Bay of Fundy, up in Nova Scotia, you know, which is one of the biggest tidal basins in the world. You know, huge, huge changes in the tide levels from the moon that far away. Now along comes a planet, not a moon, but a huge planet. You know, it's almost inconceivable to imagine how much of an influence, and it probably wouldn't be a good one, that it could have on the oceans, on the plates and the earth. You know, everything is kind of in a delicate state of balance on Earth. You know, the plates are in constant movement on the Earth's crust. You know, they're moving all the time. It's a tiny amount. Every once in a while, when it's a big amount, buildings come down. So, you know, everything is in a state of balance. And I don't think it takes very much to mess it up.
Well, that's the point. And, you know, look, we can use Earth as an example. And this applies to every planet and even to our sun and even to the moon. Everybody in space, we can picture the Earth. We've seen charts of it. There is a like an envelope or a bubble of forces all around the Earth. You have the atmosphere. You've got the magnetic field all around the Earth. You've got the ionosphere. There's just this big bubble of forces and stuff all around the Earth, and we're sitting in that soup. Okay, now all of that is held around the Earth by gravity. So if the moon has its bubble too.
Yes.
Okay, now it's... I'm going to use very unscientific terminology. Its interplay with Earth includes its forces bumping against Earth's forces, and it's the bumping of the two envelopes that creates changes on our planet, creates the tide and so forth. When you bring another huge body through the solar system, it's got a big bubble around it. A really big bubble because it's a really big planet. As it makes its way through the universe, I'm sorry, through the solar system, its forces bump against the bubbles around each of the planets. And it has to do something, it has to make changes of some kind sooner or later on each of these planets. Now, another way to think of it, you're sitting on a lake in a boat, and this lake is calm as glass. And along comes somebody with one of those big party barges, and they're not speeding, but they've got big engines, a couple of big engines on the party barge, and they pass maybe 100 yards away from you. It's a while before you feel it. But sooner or later, your boat begins to rock because of the wake from that party barge. the closer you are to the party barge, the more your boat's going to rock. But if you're far away from it, it may be just a gentle rocking. But the point is, you feel the effect. And I would think it would be very much like that to have Planet X coming through the inner solar system.
Now, here's another thing to compound the problem.
Let's compound it.
Let's compound it. Okay. I've been periodically looking at the potentially hazardous asteroids list, which was maybe 500 or 600 when I first saw it a few years ago. Now it's over 1,200.
Mm-hmm.
And they would measure the distance that it would miss the Earth in astronomical units. And one AU, as they're called, is the distance of the Earth to the Sun, is considered one AU.
Yeah.
So, you know, once in a great while, something would be, you know, 0.8 AU, you know, which is like 70 million miles or something, 60 million. But often it would be 2 or 3 AU. So these things would be on some huge elliptical orbit, and you could run a 3D Java simulation. You would see that, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, it'll just miss the Earth. But now, something's changed. And I was quite surprised when I went and looked at that exact same list of recent upcoming Earth asteroid encounters. Now, they're all listed with lunar distance, not an astronomical unit. And
so a lunar distance is roughly 300,000 miles.
That's right. We went from objects that were going to miss us by tens or hundreds of millions of miles down to hundreds of thousands of miles, and in fact, even less.
Mm-hmm.
On March 16th, an 18-meter asteroid missed us by 0.9, or less than the distance of the Earth to the Moon. And on June 2nd, a 9-meter one will do the same. Many of these are larger than that. But some of these are pretty big.
Well, what's caused that? Is it that we just have better instruments now and these things were always out there and we didn't know it? Or is something pushing them closer to us?
Well, you know, I'd heard from a Mayan woman, and she told me this back in the 90s, okay? And she was not a scientist or an engineer, just a humble lady of Mayan descent. She came from the Panama area. And she said that the Earth would be going into a part of the galaxy that has a lot of asteroids. And I looked at her because I knew she worked in a store as a clerk. I was rather surprised that she knew about this. And no one was talking about it at that time.
All right, we're going to pick up there when we come back. A break is taking over. And hold that thought. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Ted Tweetmeyer. Now, Ted, when we went away for break, you were telling us about this Mayan woman who told you that the Earth is going to be entering a part of the galaxy where there are a lot of asteroids.
Yes, and it does seem to be the case as the number of discoveries of these things increase.
How do you suspect she knew this?
She seemed to know an awful lot of things, and actually, she was abducted when she was younger, and she showed me the scars around her ankles from when they took her. It was a pretty hostile abduction. I guess she was told a number of things by them, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I always found it very interesting that how is it that hundreds and hundreds of years ago that the Mayans knew when the calendar was supposed to end? You know, that's something I've always been curious to know the answer to.
I read a very interesting article about that Mayan calendar, and, you know, who knows what to think as to, you know, which story is true. But there was a documentary made, and I think it was Leonard Nimoy that was the narrator for it. And this was back in the 70s, and it mentioned the end of the Mayan calendar in 2011.
Mm.
And since then, there have been documentaries that have talked about the end of the Mayan calendar in 2010, 2012, 2015. And there's a book out now that says that whenever they began to transfer information from the Mayan calendar into our system of dates, they missed it by about 100 years. And so that the end of the Mayan calendar is not for another 100 years. And like I said, who knows what to think about that?
Well, I can live with that.
You know, I think the thing to do is have your escape bag packed and have a plan for where to go and have provisions and do the best you can, and you'll make it or you won't. And don't worry about so much about the date on a Mayan calendar as, you know, what happens today, what happens tomorrow. You know, if you're in a place where an earthquake hits, like the one that hit Japan, they're saying about 18,000 people now. That's what they're saying. About 18,000 died. For those people, December the 21st, 2012 is completely irrelevant.
Yeah, and if you're washed out to sea and a shark finds you, then nothing mm-hmm. else matters.
Yeah. And, you know, so... that's sort of the way I approach it. Some people think that's cavalier, but I don't think so. I'm not worried about December the 21st, 2012, because we're not there yet. I got to worry about all the days between... Well, I'm not going to worry, but I've got to be ready on all the days between now and then.
It's interesting that the solar max happens to peak next year. I thought that was an interesting coincidence.
Any idea what date it peaks?
Well, I don't think it's that specific, you know, because it's an 11-year cycle, and then there's that 18-month, what they call the solar heartbeat that's inside of that 11 years. So it may be that those, like we talked about wave theory once before on your show, that, you know, the peak of the heartbeat and the peak of the solar max collide and bad things happen. I can't imagine anything good coming out of it, but I'd like to be optimistic, but it's a little tough with that one.
Well, you know, these are thrilling times to be alive. It's of course, it's thrilling sort of like being on a roller coaster. There's no thrill. It's boring when you're headed uphill, but it's when the bottom drops out. That's the thrill. And
Our lives have become so insanely complex now, you know?
Well, that's true. That's true.
You know, we're like the frog in the pot. We don't realize how complicated our lives really are. You know, there was a time when people, you know, cleaned the globes on kerosene lanterns and made candles and milked the cows and sheared the sheep and did the usual mundane things and thought nothing of it, you know. And we look back on that and it's like, oh, that's so difficult. You know, I was in a store today to an electronics store, remain nameless, to make some purchases that were tax exempt, and the girl behind the counter just was miffed. I told her that the organization was all under the same tax-exempt number, but she was all upset that she had to get a notebook out from under the counter and look it up.
Well, and God help you if you go somewhere and they have to make change without their computer telling them how much to give you.
Yes, I saw a girl once behind the counter in a hamburger place. I gave her 32 cents, and she pointed to the quarter and the other coins one at a time. I thought, oh, this is just sad. this is terrible.
All right, I want us to get back to the gravity waves that you talked about earlier. Let's say that the sun is pulsing a gravity wave. Describe for us, maybe when there's a solar flare, it pulses this gravity wave. Describe for us what that would be and what that would mean to us.
Well, I think it's instantaneously and only momentarily generated. You know, perhaps it's similar to like ball lightning, you know, where it's formed and then it's gone.
Okay.
Anyway, what it would be is like a beam of energy, if you will, that projects outward from the sun. And that's, when we see the mass ejection leave the sun, that's only an effect. It's almost like the Earth's magnetic field disturbed during an earthquake. That the mass ejection isn't what's really going on, that something else is actually going on.
Okay, and the mass ejection is how we know that something's going on.
Yes.
That's what we observe.
That's an indicator.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's M-class flares that are drawn right back into the sun. They arc out thousands of miles into space. You know, we see them from Earth all the time. Even with a small telescope and in the right kind of filter, you can see it happen. You know, these things are huge. If you can see them 93 million miles away, you can imagine how big they have to be, right?
Right.
And we can see them, but the X-class flares, they don't do that. They just take off, and they don't come back. They take straight out of the sun, and they're just, bam, they're gone, like a bullet out of a gun. They're gone.
Okay. And so with the X-class flares, that's where we would see the gravity waves, right?
That's what I believe, yes. I think that's when they're happening, is when that wave is just taking material with it. It's like somebody spitting on the sidewalk.
Okay, so if one of those hits the Earth, I mean, we think of gravity as something that pulls us down and holds us to the Earth. So if there's a gravity wave headed toward the Earth and it hits the Earth, isn't that pulling us closer to the sun?
Well, you know, that's the thing, is I don't know if it's a positive or a negative wave. It would have to have some type of polarity to it to affect the Earth's plates. But, you know, we don't really know whether it's creating a push force or a pull force. You know, I don't think that's known yet or defined, and it may not always be the same. I don't know.
But the effect of it would be something like, I think almost everybody my age will remember when we were kids, it was not uncommon, especially if you lived in a rural or semi-rural area, for kids to have a BB gun. And a BB gun is an air gun. And you cock it, and it sucks in some air and compresses it when you cock it. And it, when you pull the trigger, it releases that burst of air, and it shoves a little tiny round ball out of the gun. In most cases, in 99.9% of the cases, it's not fatal. But if you did that with no BB in it, you could hold your hand in front of the end of the gun, and you could feel the puff of air. So this gravity wave is like that puff of air hitting the Earth. It's a puff of gravity hitting the Earth, And the impact has got to have some kind of effect.
Well, it certainly would, and it, you know, it's dependent on two things: where the Earth is facing the sun, and where the sun ejects the wave. You know, it's almost like billiard balls. It's kind of a chance thing. And every once in a while, I think that we're lined right up perfectly to get hit with one of those. Mm-hmm. You got to figure the Earth must look pretty small from where the sun is. Look how small it looked from the moon. That was only 300,000 miles. So there's a certain amount of statistical probability, I guess, involved, and probably other forces to whether or not we're going to get hit with it.
I just realized I was talking and you couldn't hear me.
I'm sorry.
Not your fault. I had adjusted volume over here, but I adjusted it without looking at it, and it's one of those positive negative things. I went negative when I should have gone positive. Okay, so but wouldn't this wave have to be immensely powerful when it hits the Earth in order for it to create earthquakes?
I would think it would, or just happen to hit a fault line in just the right spot, you know, the sweet spot, to cause a shift in the plate.
Okay, that would, I think, have to be measurable. If it's strong enough to cause the tectonic plate to shift, if it's strong enough to cause a fault line to shift, that's a pretty big bump. And I would think it would have to be a measurable force that's hitting, not some secret invisible force that you can't measure. I think it would have to be measurable.
Measurable if you're in the right place with the right instrument at the right time.
Well, wouldn't seismographs that are going to measure that earthquake anyway, wouldn't they show a little bump in the beginning?
It's hard to say, you know, if they would or not. It really is. I mean, it's difficult to say yes or no.
So what do you think, Ted, when we put all of this together, and, we've got a break coming up, but let me pose the question, and when we come back from the break, I'll give you the opportunity to answer. When we put all of this together, and we're looking at, you know, there's solar flare activity associated with, whether it's the cause of or not, we don't know, but at least there's a correlation between solar activity and the earthquakes. You think there's a gravitational wave that comes with the X-Class. What do you think is our best course of action, if any? And we'll get that answer when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Ted Tweetmeyer, and we're talking about this. I say this in, I'm using the word in its most evil connotation, but this magnificent earthquake that hit Japan. And the reason I say magnificent is because you have to just stand in awe of something like this, not to admire it, but you just have to stand in awe of its power. An earthquake of lesser strength caused the death of around 250,000 people several years ago, and because of the tsunami. And this one was about 60 times more powerful than that one. You just have to stand in awe of that kind of power. I asked you before we went to break, when you put all of this together, and there's so many things that we don't have answered, so many things we don't know, what's our best course of action here? Or is there one?
Okay, we know it only takes a few minutes for what we for the light from the sun to reach us. So we see something is happening. And then, you know, there is a delay between the time it happens on the sun and the time it happens on the Earth. In that time period, control rods can be lowered into reactors. You know, all kinds of things can happen to protect life and protect property and help to avert some disasters anyway.
But when we see one of these solar flares, for instance, on your chart, we see an M-class flare, very strong, very powerful, back in February. The very first solar flare on your chart, moving from left to right, looks like it was on the 13th. It's an M-class flare. It's very powerful. It's not going to reach Earth because it's an M-class flare. But there is an earthquake, a powerful earthquake, looks like maybe 6.5, 6.6 on the Richter scale, associated with that. How do we know, and then we see a whole bunch of these earthquakes where there was no solar flare. How would we know, okay, this is a solar flare that we need to shut down the reactors as a result of this solar flare? How would we know that?
Well, we do know which ones are coming toward Earth and which ones are not, because, you know, we have satellites out there that watch it. We can tell pretty much what direction it's coming. I mean, if it heads toward a satellite that's between Earth and the sun, then, you know, pretty much there's a good chance it's going to reach Earth. The problem is I don't have all the data I wanted to put into this chart. I wanted to get the information out, and I have to apologize for it not having everything in here, but I had great trouble just finding flare activity before March. I had to go to numerous sources just to collect those. I don't know why this information is so hard to find. It surprised me immensely that it was. I'm hoping to fill this in back to the first of the year. I'll talk to some people I know and see if I can find that, because I'd like to.
Well,
see
let's address that for just a moment. We talked about it momentarily, but let's talk about it a little bit more in depth here. Why do you suspect this data has become non-available?
I don't know. Even in Australia, you know, I found the listing for March, but I couldn't. I poked around their website every which way I could and could not find much of anything for February. I found some anecdotes and some other comments and news articles to get some of the information for February, but that was about as far back as I could seem to go. I didn't have time to, you know, search every day of the month, that kind of thing, but time didn't permit that. But
well, do you think that this is a policy decision, or do you think it's just because of storage space on the servers? What do you think is causing this?
Well, I don't think storage space is an issue. That's become pretty dirt cheap nowadays. You know, you can get pocket drives that hold 8 to 16 gigabytes that are no bigger than your index finger. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this type of data requires, what, a few thousand bytes at most to retain, so it's nothing. there must be some other reason that's just not apparent. But the sun has come out of a quiet period, and you know, there are actually flares smaller than M class with different letters, but they're very minor ones that are out there. But anyway, the bottom line is there's something going on that we don't understand here, I think.
Well, I think you're right that there's something going on, and I think there are people who do understand it well enough to know that whatever's going on is not good. They don't want the public to know about it. And the evidence for that, I think, would be the lights being dimmed on the data, the data not being available. And anytime you run into a black hole in the information, there's a big reason why, and that reason's sitting right in the center of that black hole.
Yes.
So I think there are probably there are scientists that know and or at least have a pretty good idea of what the whole big picture is, and they're trying to keep it from us. And they do that because they don't want to panic people. But, you know, people are more afraid of the dark than they are the light. They're more afraid of the unknown. And it's just, I think, very counterproductive on their part to make the data disappear like that.
It would seem that way. And, you know, I thought even the Australians might have it on their two observatories, but I wasn't able to find it there either. It was very surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, Ted, I want to thank you for being a part of the show here tonight and for spending the time that you did to develop this chart and to talk with us about it. And even though there aren't any definitive answers about cause and effect, at least we can see the correlation. At least we can see there's something connecting this solar activity and the earthquakes. And I think that's a very important step forward. And I want to thank you again for being with us.
Well, you're welcome. It was as always, it's a lot of fun to be here with you, Kevin, and be on again sometime.
All right. Stay on the line with me for a moment, if you will. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we looked at this phenomenal earthquake that took place in Japan. And later this week, we're going to look at it again, but we're going to be looking at it from a different angle. And I hope you'll join us for each and every show and not miss a single show, because if you do miss a show, you miss a universe of information. Tomorrow night, we're going to be talking about the mysterious origins of man from the perspective of Marshall Clarfield. And you want to be sure and be here for that. He's written a book about it, and he wants to talk with us about it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.